A quick message before we get on with the podcast today. We're delighted to let you know that 101 Top Property Tips is going to be live to the world, live to the market on Wednesday, the 15th of July. We've got over 50 contributors to this book, people that have been in property for years and years and years with a wealth of experience, and everyone's teamed up together to provide various top property tips. The idea being that this helps you and it helps us, helps everyone to learn from the mistakes that other people have made. Now, whether you're a seasoned professional, whether you're just getting started in property, this book's going to have everything that you can think of, from tips on due diligence to tips on dealing with builders, dealing with architects. Wednesday, 15th of July, 101 Top Property Tips is going to be available to the world. You can buy it on Amazon, paperback, and the Kindle version. So mark that date in your calendar. And now, on with the show. That's Neil, that's one hell of an introduction. We're going to be deep diving into commercial conversions today. I just want to say a massive thank you for your time and for being able to sit down and talk through these processes.
No problem.
In terms of a little bit of background about yourself, you mentioned that at the age of 14, you went into drawing offices and then you designed your parents' house at the age of 19. So has there always been a passion for drawing and doing that sort of work?
Yeah. So it's I guess the best way to describe it is it's my life's work, really. I was always technically minded at school, and was always going to go into design. Architecture was what I picked. A lot of people say, what was your background before property? And the short answer to that is primary school. Because as soon as I could start to use a computer and draw, it was buildings that I focused on, starting working first of all at Booker Cash and Carry. I drew up all of their cash and carries across the country. That's where I sort of started doing when I was 14, and went into architectural drawing offices from the age of 17. And like I say, from 19 onwards, started working on my own projects, including mum's house.
That's pretty cool. Not many people would be designing their own parents' house at the age of 19.
Yeah, and having those arguments with your mum at the age of 19 as well, and telling her that she's completely wrong about how she wants to design her house is a interesting position to be in. But it worked, and the great thing is them, and that made them my mum and my stepdad. It made them financially independent, from that point onwards. So it was one of those things where we bought a house. There was a spare bit of land next to it. Somebody had offered them £25,000 to buy it from them, and they got all excited about having £25,000 in their pockets. And I convinced them that the better thing to do from a business point of view was to build a new house. And I think they profited £225,000 from the deal in the end when they finally sold it. So it was a big difference.
Yeah, massive difference. So I suppose that's one of those differences between being there in the now and then trying to see a few years ahead, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome stuff. Well, we'll go deep dive into commercial conversions. And the thing I love about this is, rather than coming from an investor's point of view as such, we're going to go from an architect's point of view. So slightly different, but also you've had a great vested interest in property as well. So for those that might not know, what is a commercial conversion and how do they work?
So a commercial conversion is what's called a permitted development play. It's essentially buying an office or another type of commercial space that falls within the guidance, and it's converting it from that space into residential dwellings, either as individual dwellings or as an HMO, or you can do it to serviced lets and things like that. So it's essentially starting with one class use and flipping it into a residential class use.
Okay, great. And then that sounds relatively straightforward. So we're just at the tip of the iceberg, of course, as you know. From an investor's point of view, and again, I suppose everything's going to be from an investor's point of view, if they're thinking about doing this strategy, who would they need in their team? What does a normal process look like from finding property to getting it sorted at the other end?
certainly, yeah, it's good to have an architect in your team, for one. The main reason being is because obviously commercial buildings are not designed for residential uses. And what we see a lot of is we see a lot of people that have either set up a deal and it's already agreed and they've worked on their numbers from a particular angle, or they've just seen a commercial property and they think every single commercial property is easy to convert, and they're bringing those to us. And we get asked to shoehorn things into buildings that just are not possible architecturally when you start to think of things. But when you start to think about what residential occupiers are going to need. And so certainly having somebody that knows what they're doing from an architectural point of view from an early stage really helps. We find that clients go to planning consultants first, which I understand the mentality behind it, because this is a planning play, it's a permitted development play. People think, right, let's talk to a planning consultant. What investors have to understand is that planning consultants essentially just deal with I've got to be careful here, most planning consultants essentially just deal with the paperwork exercise of changing a building from one use to another. They're not experts in the implementation of that change of use. And it's the implementation of that change of use which is where the profit really lies. So there is obviously there's value increase by moving from commercial to residential, but the money that gets left on the table is by not understanding how to lay that building out correctly and how to get the most for the end, the use that you're moving to. And this is the same for all change of use projects, but particularly in commercial conversions. You classic ones are forgetting about escape routes. So you've got a different criteria. So because it's a planning play, the investors don't look at the building regs issues until they've got the deal over the line. And then all of a sudden, the building regs issues come and bite you in the backside. And then like I said, fire escape is a classic one where from a commercial point of view, you've got an open plan office. Your fire escape distances are huge, particularly if you've got a couple of staircases. You subdivide that all up into residential units, and now you need to put a new staircase. But that wasn't factored into. That wasn't factored in for the design, and that wasn't factored in for the areas. And all of a sudden, the units disappeared, or you've got to spend an extra God knows how many thousand sticking a staircase on the side. So that's why it's very, very important to have somebody in your power team who truly understands how to lay out a building and how to really get the most out of that square footage.
You mentioned there a permitted development. What is permitted development? How does it work? And what's it applicable to at the moment?
So permitted development is the right to do something without planning permission. Now, the way that commercial conversions work is that, I mean, if you wind back 10 years, essentially, the way permitted development worked was that you could read the documents and just crack on with it and not worry. When these special cases started to be added into permitted development, so the reason permitted development has expanded is because the local authority just does not have time to deal with all of the planning applications that are coming through. So that's why they expand out permitted development rights, and that is why they dropped in commercial conversions. And so when they did that, they had to cover their backs a little bit and put in a system that's called prior notice or prior approval. And essentially what that is you have to submit to the local authority some very basic information to just confirm that what you're doing definitely doesn't require planning permission. So it's an extra step in, but essentially permitted development is all of the work that you can do without planning permission. It's a much lighter weight process. Obviously, it means it speeds things up because you don't get into arguments about unit sizes and numbers and what have you. You're focusing very much on the change of use from one class of building type to another class of building type. And it's, yeah, certainly a lot more streamlined than the planning process.
So a lot quicker, a lot more cost effective, because the planning, anyone that's sat through planning before knows that it can be an absolute ball ache. That's probably a nice way of putting it, sometimes, depending on who you're dealing with.
Yeah, but also because of this, because it is a relatively straightforward process, it's also got some huge pitfalls in it, where you can come unstuck very, very easily. One of the classics is if you've got an office that's actually that's in an area where offices are needed. So quite often you'll have local authorities will put restrictions on areas to say that commercial conversions cannot be done to resi. That's called a class 4 restriction. Also, you'll get spaces where you buy it thinking it's an office, and then you find out a little bit later on that the local authority has the class used down as something different. And we've seen this a lot with, we saw this actually quite a bit in London, where you've got spaces over shops that may have been used for offices, but when you go to the council, it's down as a distribution centre, or it's down as a warehouse space. Now, you can do commercial conversions from warehouse space to residential, but the sizes that you're allowed to look at are slightly different, and all of a sudden you find that you've got another step in the process where you have to prove that it was used as an office first to then get your conversion over. So that's where all of a sudden you can, a project that seemed like it was going to take a couple of weeks turns into 6 months of arguing with a planning officer that there definitely was desks in there and it hasn't been used as storage space. I'm just trying to think of other ones that have come up a cropper. The other one is if the property hasn't been marketed properly. So they still want to see that there was an effort to make sure that the office use is no longer needed. And you do get those scenarios where a local authority will push back that they don't want to lose that commercial space locally, and that can cause a bit of an issue. But in general, the key ones where people get caught out are being sold something that they think is an office, and actually it wasn't on the council records, is down to something different, and that can really come back and bite you in the backside. It's as bad as having a conveyancing plan that's wrong. It's that sort of issue to your project, and can really, really slow things down.
So I was just thinking, it's one of those things that sort of looks like a cat, walks like a cat, but it's actually a dog.
Sort of,
yeah, stands. Very much so. Yeah, yeah, and the property world is full of those. Absolutely full of those. Due diligence is always, even with the simple simple conversions, the easy routes, due diligence is still the most important thing that you can do on a project, because that's what can catch you out. And I think agents have become a lot more savvy over the last few years to this, and so the price for commercial property has gone up, knowing that it can be converted into residential. I mean, I remember one probably 6-7 years ago, this was in Ealing, and we were on site talking to an agent. The property was up for about 1.5 million. Absolutely perfect for residence conversion, and the agent had no idea that this could be done. It wasn't on their radar that you could do a permitted development change from commercial to residential, until some loudmouth mentioned it a couple of days later, and the price overnight went up by £1 million. And I think in the end, they managed to double their asking price for the building, because the agent finally found out that the residential conversion was possible. So things are very different now, though. All agents do know that commercial property has the ability to flip to residential, and again, so you can get caught out with overpaying if you're not careful.
And no matter what strategy you're looking at, as you say, due diligence is fundamental. Knowing your numbers is fundamental as well. What other things do you think that investors need to think about when they're looking at potential opportunities? You've touched on some great things so far, but is there anything else that springs to mind that investors would need to look at?
I think being pessimistic about what the build cost is going to be, is really important. I think because quite often it's easy to walk into a building and say, right, well, I've got a floor, I've got walls, and I've got a ceiling. All I've got to do is put a bit of stud work in between, and hey presto, I've got my units. But actually, understanding what from a regulatory point of view, understanding what you're going to need to do to upgrade that building to a residential standard. And this is what a lot of people just don't realise, that a commercial wall is not the right standard for a residential wall, and you're going to have to do something to it to either improve its thermal qualities or its sound qualities, particularly if you're in certain areas, if you need train tracks and things like that. And also, you're going to be looking at different what's called compartmentation from floor to floor. So you may be looking at higher fire regs from one floor to another, higher sound regs from one floor to another. And this is where all of a sudden what looked like a £500 a square meter refurb turns into virtually being the price of a new build. And that's where you've got to be really, because you've also got the buggeration factor of dealing with these buildings where you're standing in it and it's just, for God's sake, I didn't realize I had to do that as well. And actually stripping stuff out is expensive. You know, when you're taking stuff out and getting rid of it, asbestos, you know, all of these things that can be in these buildings, and they're very, very likely to be there. You know, all of a sudden that puts in a lot of invisible costs that people just won't have realized if they haven't gone through it themselves before. So that's that. Once you're over the line, once you're getting towards the line, that understanding the potential cost for refurb and not looking at it and saying, well, I can take roof, wall and floors out because they're there, is vitally important. You should look at these buildings as though they're a structural system only, and then everything else, you're going to have to put in. And if you get to save on something further down the line, brilliant. That's money in your pocket. But if you expect to reuse a lot of what's there, you will be upset at some point.
So effectively look at the building as an empty shell and always take the worst case scenario. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah. Just assume it's nothing more than a concrete frame or a steel frame with a little bit of infill, but everything else you should be expecting to put in. Expect to upgrade everything. That way you won't be sorely disappointed if it doesn't work out.
In terms of finding an area that works for commercial conversions, how would people go about knowing what areas are going to be good for these sort of projects and what areas aren't going to be good?
I think the short answer to that is making sure there are other residential units around. I mean, it's not unheard of. We have seen resi conversions pop up in surprising areas that are quite heavily commercial. That's happening less and less now. Councils have caught on and are very careful to protect the important areas from a commercial perspective. But certainly if you've got neighbouring residential, if you've got residential within a street or so, you know, there's a target there. Avoid things that are obviously, you know, when you're getting into areas that are heavily industrial. Even if they do border a residential area, you'll struggle and you'll just be creating slums. And at the end of the day, that the big backlash that has come around commercial conversions has been around the creation of slums in certain areas where less conscientious developers, shall we say, have used the fact that you can get away with a lot. You can undersize your units. You can cram a lot of people in there and you know, not provide them parking and what have you. And they create major problems. And okay, it might be great for cash flow for the early days, but you don't want to be the name on the BBC that you know, the one in your area, and now you've got problems with prostitution and you know, and people not paying their rent and all the other stuff that goes with creating creating slum buildings. So look for somewhere that is that borders between residential and commercial. In towns are going to be great. You know, if you think about what we've got coming up with coronavirus and the pressure that we've got on we already had on town centres. There is a lot of empty space. There's a lot of empty commercial space sitting above shops, waiting for someone to do something with it. You know, if we want to talk about regenerating town centres, get people in there, get people living in a town centre. And if you're living in a town centre, it's really easy to go down and start spending on the high street. So, you know, look for these opportunities that sit above shops, not necessarily takeaways and clubs and things like that, but look for the ones that sit above the daytime activities. So then they're pleasant places to live at night. You know, avoid the ones that are above the nightlife and above the sort of smells and noises that you can get in those bits. But there's loads of opportunity there, loads and loads where there's particularly buildings that have been owned for a long time. Yeah, things that people picked up in the 50s and 60s, and they're just nothing with that space above. You can see the dead windows. They're a lovely opportunity if you can find out who owns the building and get yourself a reasonable deal when it comes to the freehold and that space. But yeah, as long as, like I say, but if you're going for more conventional office blocks, you want to make sure that they bound residential areas, definitely.
So you've got some great points there as well, and it just brought me to thinking, at what point would an investor need to engage in an architect service? Would they need to do that before they go and view a property? I mean, so from an architect's point of view, how does that work? So obviously we don't want to, from an investor's point of view, I wouldn't want to be, you know, taking the piss. There's only so much free stuff people can give out, times money. How would that work from your point of view?
I think the best thing to do, and this is something that surprises me with a lot of investors, is that they're not open and honest from the get-go about what they want to do. So if you're green, if this is your first, you know, your first venture into this sort of thing, go and sit with an architect and tell them that. Tell them that this is what you want to do, this is your strategy, and this is how you want to work. You're going to look at 40 properties over the next couple of months, but you don't really know what you're looking at. And what can you agree with that architect to learn some lessons? And what you really want to do, what you want to look at that as investing in your education. And so you might agree that, I don't know, you're going to spend 50 quid, 100 quid, whatever, per potential deal, to just have a quick eyes over and talk about the opportunity that is there. After you've done that a few times, you will then be in a position where you can do that upfront stuff, where you can go and you probably only need to do 10, 15 deals, you know, and you'll be in a position where you can walk in and the first thing you'll think is, fire eggs, sound engineering, da, da, da. Yeah, all of these things will pop into your head. So use that as an investment in your education, and then you'll have also created a good relationship with somebody that when that deal comes off, you know who to go and talk to and move forward with, and you won't have burnt any bridges because you'll have valued their time correctly and allowed them to sort of upskill you to do these little assessments yourself. And I think developers spend a lot of time and money sitting around the table with other investors at, you know, PPN groups and what have you, and there's this whole no money down, don't go and spend on, you know, try and get everyone to do everything you can for you for free, and you know, don't invest any of your own money. Bullshit. So, you know, stop spending money on PPN. Go and find an architect to work with for a month or two. Build that back up, and then go back to PPN with your new set of skills. And you know, just make sure that you're investing in your education in lots of different ways, rather than just in these very you know, the lots of investors sitting together and you know, telling each other their stories, you know, you also need to go out and spend a little bit of money with consultants and but use that in the right way. Use that to get your education up.
Any other do's and don'ts when dealing with architects?
Don't call technicians architects. That's a really bad one. Make sure that you know who you're working with. There are two types of professional out there, technicians and architects, and they are very, very different in the way that they work. And you find that you get that the two get lumped together, and it's like chalk and cheese. But the key thing is, you know, like I said, know who you're working with, build a good relationship with them, and respect their time and value. And if you do that, you will get so much more out of it. You know, and the irony is that if you show that you respect somebody's time and value, you'll get more for free. you'll get more love back. It's that whole thing about that reciprocal relationship. I think when you go in and you go in with the approach, well, other people will do it for free, well, I'll fucking go and use other people then. You know, that's the way that we've always looked at it. Because you are asking somebody to help you make a shed load of money, and so you should respect that relationship, and you should nurture it in the same way that you would nurture your investors to help build your portfolio up.
So effectively had the right mentality. So if I walked into your offices, not that I would, but if I walked into your offices and I said, Neil, I'm looking at this, and he said, yeah, no problem, Rob, let's have a couple of hours, X amount, no problem. If I then get shirty about that and go, well, my mate John down the road can do it for free, then that's going to get your back up, because you're thinking that guy's got the wrong mentality.
Well, yeah, because the short answer to that is, if John's doing it for free, he is not putting enough effort in to make you your maximum value. The reason that my time costs money is because I make people an extraordinary amount of money. You know, it's eye-watering, the amount of money and profit that I make people a year. And that has a value. If you want that service, if you want a free service, go and talk to someone that makes a little bit of money for people a year, and they will give you a free service because it's free because there is no major value in the advice that they're giving. The amount of projects that we have to fix, and particularly when it comes to commercial conversions and things like that, because the free advice left so much on the table. It's shocking. It is absolutely shocking. There are so many property deals out there that are being screwed up by not creating good relationships with good quality commercially minded teams. And it's not just for us. The same with structural engineers and other guys that you get. Yeah, M&E consultants that you're going to get involved. Get the right guys on board, and all of a sudden you'll be getting tax rebates through your ears. You know, if you get the right M&E consultant on board, you know, that stuff doesn't come for free. It's the same with structural engineers. Talk to the right structural engineer, and you'll find out that there is the opportunity to stick two floors on top of your commercial conversion. Well, if that's not worth a 500-quid conversation, I don't know what is. You know, it's that value. It's that stuff that the one man bands that the we do all the free advice doesn't give you in the end. Because there's no incentive to push the boundaries and just work out how we get every single square foot out of the deal for you. So I will always stick to that hard line that you shouldn't be asking for free advice. Certainly not at the onset. You know, fine if you've done 40 projects with somebody, yeah, do you know what? No, a bit of free advice, no worries there. But if it's early doors, realize that it's an investment. Free advice is not an investment, and you shouldn't expect to get a return on free advice.
No, free advice is worth every penny. as a common sense.
Exactly.
You mentioned there that you make people a shed load of money, and you know, no pun intended, of course. I just thought that made me laugh. A common question that you might get when you give a comment like that is people might look and go, "Well, Neil, well, why don't you do that yourself?"
Well, I have to ask myself that question. To be fair, I do. I invest a bit in property myself, and I'm starting to build up a portfolio. For me, I generally buy and hold things. We're just starting to look at a building now. I certainly wouldn't give people advice on stuff that I don't do. I've had my fingers burnt. I made a huge mistake. You know, even somebody like me that's been in the industry for a long, long time, I made a huge mistake that cost me it's probably cost me about 150,000, maybe a little bit more now, in my time and effort. I got in bed with the wrong people. I met a couple of guys that they needed an architect and they wanted investment, and it turns out, didn't know what they were doing when it came to handling the finance side of things. I entrusted my money with from that point of view. You know, I knew what I was doing from the design and the architecture side of things, but they were meant to be dealing with the money, and they fucked up, and they lost me money, and they lost a friend of mine money. And so I went out and educated myself so that that would never happen again, and so that it would never happen to any of our clients. That's why I say you don't learn until you get your fingers burned. A lot of people, a lot of architects have never been anywhere near it. Yeah, they don't get involved in that investing side. They don't go and find out how to stack a deal and why you need to have 20% on GDV, and they don't understand that borrowing costs that need to sit within there and how that works. That's been why we've educated ourselves as a company, why I've educated myself personally. I don't want to get burnt again. It hurts. I do it myself. I am still recovering from that loss. You know, it takes time to build it back up again. I'm glad to say that I have. Yeah, I've gone back past the point of zero, so it's been about built back up again, and we're back in the green. I didn't do my due diligence. I trusted somebody, I made a huge mistake, and by doing that, you know, that is what's driven me to be able to make a shitload of money for everybody else, because I made the mistake. I've burnt up my fingers and turned it around. So certainly not. I certainly wouldn't call myself a property mogul or anything like that. I've got enough things and enough pies to be able to use experience and knowledge and say, trust me, this is the way forward.
No, that's good stuff. That's good times. It's taking that pain point, taking those lessons and learning from that. That's crucial in any walk of life, to be honest with you. Swinging back to permitted development, you mentioned we've touched upon that briefly already, and I assume most people are going to be thinking offices, etc., etc. But are there any other permitted developments? Any permitted development rights that are around that don't involve offices?
Yeah, there are a few. There's actually quite a lot going on with permitted development now. Again, because of what's going on with coronavirus, there's an opportunity to change between other classes, and particularly to switch to the distribution centers, which a lot of people don't think there's money in that. But when you're looking at the rise in companies like Amazon, where distribution is king, so it isn't just permitted development moving to a residential class that's profitable. Permitted development moving to other classes can be. You've got the classic bar conversions, although then that has to come with the caveat that local authorities are shutting down on those quite heavily. They're using some very 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 slight wording change. I'm trying to word it properly myself. Slight discrepancies in the wording to essentially prove that buildings are not structurally, barns are not structurally sound. So you'll find now with most barn conversions, you need to have a structural report to prove that you can put a floor in it, for example. So that's a classic one. You can convert from shops to residential. That's available. And again, I think we probably will see that a little bit more. But we have to be really careful to not kill the high street. Go back to what I was saying earlier, that use the space above. If you put people above shops, you've got a reason to go down and use the shop. So we don't want to completely kill the high street, although that there is opportunity to do that. A plethora of other different types of building can be converted into residential. So it's not just an office. But to be honest, the guidance is relatively straightforward to open up and have a look in yourself, and you don't need to be an expert to pick up the change of use planning policy guide and see what buildings are named in there as being possible changes to residential. But you do need an expert to make sure you're going to get the most out of it, because again, a lot of these buildings are just not suitable or they're not going to get the units that you think out of them. So that's where the skill and caution needs to kick in.
And then switching over to a regular planning process, can you talk us through a normal planning process, what it's like, how that works, step by step?
So a normal planning process. So the big difference there is the amount of information that you need to put in, and that's going to get worse and worse over the next few years. I mean, being in the industry as long as I have, I can remember when I was 18 and first started putting in planning permissions. I literally could phone up the local authority, talk to Joe Bloggs, the case officer, who was the case officer, same case officer I was dealing with last month. Ask them what information they want. They tell me the drawings. I'd send it over to them. It took a couple of days to put the stuff together and get it in, and I'd have an approval in a few weeks' time. Now you have to invest heavily, and the reason that you have to invest heavily is because of huge stories such as Grenfell. They're starting to impact the planning system because people are asking, well, how does this happen? How do we get slums? How do we get dangerous buildings? And why do we have neighbor disputes? And it's being all pulled right back to the front of the planning system. So currently, when you put together a planning application, you can expect to run back to when I was about 18 and working in doing planning applications. I could phone up the local authority, I could agree with them the drawings that they needed, and I'd have my planning permission in a couple of weeks' time. Now you have to put in a huge investment, and like I said, you have to put in this huge investment because there have been so many big stories such as Grenfell and other major problems and disasters, neighborhood disputes, etc., where the question is coming back to could we have dealt with this right at the beginning, and that's what's informing the planning process. So what we have to do now is you have your architectural drawings that are going to go in, but you also need your design and access statement, which is going to describe how and why you're doing what you're doing, and why it looks like it, how it looks, and why you've got the the sort of pedestrian and vehicle accesses that, that you're going for. It's going to cover off scale and how it fits in within the street scene. You'll then probably have a separate planning document that's going to cover off all of the planning policy. There is now so much planning policy that what we want to do is we want to give the case officer as much information as we can so that they don't have to go and do all of the research. You will have transport issues. So you'll have a transport report that will tell the local authority what's going on with buses and pedestrian routes and is it sustainable location. You will have ecology, depending on where you are. You know, is there bats in the roof? Are there newts on the site? You will have, if you're in town, you're going to have sound issues that need looking at. The list goes on. Structural engineering now is really starting to come into it. You know, councils are throwing back and saying, actually, is this building structurally sound? Can you do what you're saying you can do without knocking it down? So all of these extra reports that have to go in, and what's coming down the line for people, and this is post Grenfell, what's coming down the line is that soon we're going to have to start to put in building regulations information. We are going to have to start to tell the local authority, before we get planning permission, how we're going to deal with fire exits and how we're going to deal with, we're already having to tell them how we're going to deal with energy, but now it's going to go to a whole other level. And this is to try and avoid mass disasters. I mean, if the system was just right in the first place, it wouldn't happen, but we are where we are. And investors need to understand that their upfront costs are going to go through the roof when that happens. And I think that, I think if people don't understand this and people don't understand why they have to make these investments, you're going to end up with, again, a lot of very, very poor planning applications coming out the back that aren't really worth the money that people, the investors think they are, because someone else has got to come in and fix all the issues. And time, I think one thing that people don't appreciate with planning now is that it is a long-winded process. If you are another big bugbear of mine is the those that tell you they've got 100% success rate in the planning system. If you have 100% success rate in the planning system, you are leaving money on the table for your clients. The planning system is a negotiating process to get the best for you as an investor. And so if you factor in the right amount of time, instead of setting up your option deals or whatever it is, whatever mechanism you set up with very tight, well, I'm going to get this all finished in a year. If you get your options with a bit more legroom in them, say 18 months, so you've got the ability to go back to the planners again, you will be able to test the planning system at a higher level, and then if it comes back as a problem, negotiate down to what is the best solution for you, rather than going in with something just to get planning permission. And where we've had success on this before, I mean, we were bought a site in Bushy, where we were asked to get 9 units on it, I think, and we got 19, and we got 19 because we knew that we could push it a little bit harder, and there was no way we were going to leave that value on the table for the client. So you use the planning system as a negotiating tool rather than with this whole, I've got to get it done in one hit, and if it's not done in one hit, it's terrible and I've lost my reputation. No, my reputation lies on the fact that I get the best value rather than pushing it through as quickly as possible. And that again is about educating the investors and educating the landowner, because you're just trying to get the best value for everybody. And a landowner will have a longer option with you if they believe they're going to get the best deal out of it. So expect planning to be a bit of a back and forth process that takes longer than just the 8 weeks that they are they're meant to get back to you in.
You've got some great pointers there, and it's brought me on to thinking about the not hidden costs as such. No, I've lost my train of thought. Planning, the time it takes for a planning process. So, if you're
if you don't know a lot about property or you don't know a lot about what's going on, yes, you know, as you mentioned, Grenfell, really bad, not good, houses happen, loss of life, you know, that's horrific. And we learn lessons from that. But then when you've got government and people that, you know, are saying we've got housing shortages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and yet the planning process can seemingly take so long, and it's always a back and forth between, I mean, what do you, how do you feel about that? Is it you're trying to have your cake and eat it, or is it just a case of it is what it is? Do you reckon that that process can be made slightly easier so we there can be more units moving forward to meet this demand for housing?
Yeah, well, that's what the central government are trying to do with permitted development. That is the point of the permitted development changes, to try and ease up the system. The problem when you understand what's going on from an economic point of view, we have a major issue, and investors are not going to like this, but it's the reality. We have a major issue with a planning system that monetizes, or rather with a process that monetizes planning permission. So because it is possible to buy a piece of land, get planning permission on it, and then not do anything for a number of years, and your investment will go up without even having to implement the houses, that in itself slows down building. I mean, if you, the big house builders have got enough planning applications and enough enough houses in their pipeline to make a major dent in the housing crisis, but they don't, because their investment strategy means holding the land, keeping those options going. That, you know, their value is increasing. They only need to release those houses when the market in that area is right for them to release the houses. And it doesn't matter what anyone says, that's what's going on. And so while we've got that system, we're always going to struggle, because there's no incentive to put spade in the ground and start digging. But on a small scale, there are hundreds of developers that want to build. And these two things are pulling in a different direction. And because the small scale developers don't have the clout that the big scale developers have, you get this really weird scenario where if you're, you know, without picking any names out of the hat, if you're one of the super house builders, you can take 10 acres of land to the planning authority and say, right, we are going to shift all your boundaries around and we're going to get X hundred houses on these acres. And then I'm going to bank them. I'm going to sit on that for 10 years. I'm not going to do anything about it. But now your housing supply is sorted out. So now you've got a situation where your local authority housing supply for the next 5 years is dealt with. Small developer comes along with half an acre. I want to get five houses on. No. Why? Well, we've got a housing supply sorted out. Yeah, but it's not going to get built for 10 years. Yeah, no. Housing supply sorted out. And this is because the local authorities are not commercially minded, and they don't care about that stuff. They care about who's going to vote for them. They care about, you know, who's going to be complaining and sending in letters and moaning, and do you know what? And they just deal with it all in one big hit with a major application, and they don't really want to deal with it with the little ones. And that is screwing everything from an investor point of view. That is really, really causing problems in the system. And so that's where permitted development comes in to start to free this up. But as with everything, you know, you do get people that abuse it. So permitted development has created slums, and now you're getting a backlash from government, from local authority to try and take away those rights because they've been abused. And the next big play that's coming down the line is airspace. That if you're looking at commercial conversions, that is where the cream is on the cake, because if you get it right, if you buy somewhere that you can convert into residential and then pop an extra couple of floors on top, happy days. That's where the next advancement is going to come from commercial conversions. And even if it doesn't come as soon as we think it's going to come, if you're doing a commercial conversion, keep hold of the freehold, because you're the one then that's got the ability to do the airspace additions. And these things are put there to help free up the system a bit, to help get, you know, some more units in. But fundamentally, we do have a major, major problem with how the planning system monetizes land, or how the planning system creates value. And until central government does something along the lines of making planning permissions, attaching planning permissions to the person rather than the land. So the developer has to implement that planning permission. If they don't implement that planning permission, it is lost, you know, and then therefore devaluing the land. That's the only way we're going to really get houses moving. But nobody's going to sign up to that, because it takes a lot of value out of the system. It's too socialist for investors to think along those lines. But all that would happen is your money would be made in property instead. You know, the money wouldn't disappear. The money would just move to the building rather than the planning gains. But vote for me and I'll sort it out. Until that point, we'll just deal with what we've got. And what we've got is a shitty system that isn't fit for purpose, that doesn't allow small developers to fill the hole in the market that they desperately want to fill. And so that's why PD gains are so attractive, because that's where you've got a chance of not getting caught up in this, you know, circus of a process, to be able to actually do what you came to do, which is create residential dwellings and give people places to live.
You mentioned briefly there about space rights above buildings. So, you know, again, for those people that are thinking, "Oh, what the hell is he talking about?" Can you just explain that a little bit more, how that would work?
Yeah. So the detail isn't completely worked out yet. It's been in consultation for a little while, and we're expecting to see it come out soon. I think everything that's gone on with coronavirus and what have you is just going to put delays in the system. Essentially, what it's saying is that if you have a property, you will be able to put additional stories on top. I think the limit is sort of to 5 stories. It will be dependent on neighbouring properties. It will be dependent on the street scene. It will be dependent on you know, heights that already exist. But certainly in built-up urban areas, there's going to be good opportunity to go up without any major planning requirements. And if you think about it at the moment, I mean, PD exists on residential properties to go into loft spaces only. This is talking about something a bit more meaty. You know, at least 1-2 additional stories on top of most properties. That's. The devil's going to be in the detail, you know, as we've said, and they are going to be, again, prior approval applications where you're going to have to show certain things. One of them is likely to be that the structure of the building doesn't need to be massively altered. But also there's another interesting one coming down the line, which is, and this one is really causing controversy. In that you can completely replace the mass of a commercial building for a residential building. That is absolutely huge. That is absolutely off the scale huge. If they do this, if they put this through, those empty blocks, those empty office blocks that you see when you're sitting on the train, you're going into London, and you can see them all, you know, half vandalized and nobody's wanted to rent the space for ages. Big posters up saying, you know, serviced office spaces, and no, you know, there's not been a cleaner there for God knows how long. They can just be dropped and replaced with a new residential building, and that is huge. That is absolutely huge if that comes through. But that's, you know, very controversial. It's very much in for discussion at the moment. So this is where. This is where the commercial stuff is. It's got its, you know, we're just sort of finishing off what I would call generation one of commercial conversions. You know, we're moving into gen 2, gen 3, where you've got these abilities to stick on extra floors and to potentially drop the whole mass and replace it without a formal planning application. How it all works out, I can't see them not putting in something around transport and amenity and the big thing will be around, you know, the Section 106s and SIL. That's where, you know, PD really comes into its own, because you won't have those huge additional taxes on development, which is also slowing people down.
Yeah, going into Section 106 and SIL, it's almost like you've predicting the questions before I ask them. What is Section 106? What is SIL? How does that work? Because obviously that's going to impact the numbers. So talk us through that.
So Section 106 and SIL is a kind of a good idea that was, as always, badly implemented. So what it is a developer tax. It's a tax on development. And when you understand why it's needed, you get it. So if you're particularly Section 106, Section 106 was the first one that came through, and then SIL came on later. Section 106 sort of looks at key local amenities such as schools and libraries and parks and what have you, and it says if you're going to build 100 houses here, you're going to have an impact on all of these things, and we would like you to contribute to these things, but via a tax, rather than taking more money from the local inhabitants. So it moves tax from your council tax bill to a developer tax to improve these facilities. SIL came in a bit later as more of a blanket tax, where they don't really. The problem with Section 106 is that if local authorities weren't spending it on what they said they were going to spend it on, developers could claim it back. Now, SIL is a bit more of a blanket, you know, you're just paying us a tax for building in our area, and local authorities were allowed to basically consult and pick what they wanted to charge per square foot, square meter of development. So it is a tax, but it doesn't come into play when you're doing PD. It doesn't come into play. Also, even when you're not doing PD, so when you're doing a planning application on commercial land, if there are existing buildings there, you can play the two off against each other. So your existing buildings versus your new scheme. Because commercial space, obviously, yeah, commercial space has an impact on local amenity. So there was already business rates being paid. And if you've got X metres of commercial space that you're losing, you can weigh that against the residential space you're adding and get essentially only pay the difference. So it's one of those things that you need to get into and really pay attention to, because it can completely bulge your scheme up, particularly if you're looking to flip that planning application. You can get really caught out and add multiple hundreds of thousands into the cost to purchase your site. And when you've sat down with a landowner at the beginning and you've told them how many millions their site is worth, and you're doing your flip and you want to get rid of it, and all of a sudden there's this 150 grand sitting on the table that needs paying somewhere, it's got to come out of somebody's pocket, and inevitably it comes out of it should come out of the land value. And if it doesn't, it ends up just pushing up the price of houses, which is why it doesn't quite work as it should do, because just ill-conceived. But you know, we are where we are. It's one of those things that we have to put up with. And you can negotiate it out. You can, you know, if you're doing particular types of development. So if you're only doing one bed flats, it wouldn't make sense for you to give a contribution to schools. So you can have sensible conversations around Section 106. That if your development just does not impact it. If you're designing an old people's home, for example, you know, again, you're not going to impact schools. So you can negotiate around it, but you just have to be prepared that it's the only way that local authorities can rinse money out of developers. So they're going to protect it very, 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 very carefully. And you will have to pay, if you want to get out of paying these taxes, you will have to pay a considerable amount of money, first of all, to do an appraisal to show why your scheme shouldn't pay it. And then you'll have to do an appraisal for the local authority, or rather you have to pay for them to do an appraisal to argue why it should. So yeah, you still pay some money towards it, but you have to be pretty confident that you're going to get away with it before you go trying to squeeze out of it.
Oh, and as you say on that as well, where most councils up and down the country are not necessarily very commercially minded, and when, you know, when central funding from government goes down, etc., it creates a pinch for them. Then it just seems that every time it's who's the easiest set of people we can pick on. Oh, anyone that's going to put money into buying property or go through any form of development.
It's a, like I said, when you understand what's going on with local authority and central government and the fact that the two of them are pulling in different directions. You know, you can see why these things come about and why they become fractious and why they don't get implemented properly. But it's only ever going to be, the reason it's developers that have to deal with it is because it's developers are the ones that are motivated to get on with it. You know, it's not, the local authorities just want the money. You know, so they're not, you know, from their point of view, they see it as you should be paying. So why, we don't need to fix the situation. Central government don't want to pay money to local authorities, so they don't want to fix the situation. So the only people that are motivated to deal with it are the ones that whose pockets it's going to come out of. So that's why developers have to accept that they need to, again, educate themselves on these things and look for opportunities to save where they legally can save, but accept that it is a cost of development where they legally can't, and factor that into land offers.
That all makes perfect sense to me. So let's say that moving forward, so we've gone through PD, planning, we've got everything that we need one way or another. We've worked out the numbers, we've worked out Section 106, we've worked out to see if there is or isn't any happy days. So the planning's been given, or, you know, we've got it through PD. In terms of then seeing the project out, because as you say, you know, some investors might get that permission and then look to flip that and make a profit that way, but some will actually then go and build it out. In terms of building out a site, is that something they engage with separate companies? Is that something an architectural practice can help with? If so, what, you know, fees would investors need to factor into their budget when considering that option?
Well, you've got multiple choices at this point. I mean, a practice like ours, where we do construction as well as design, we would look at doing things like managing the construction under a management contract. But it really depends. It depends what your appetite is and how you're investing. So, first of all, I would always say that if you're trying to build a deal pipeline and you are trying to move from one project to another to keep going, do not get involved in stuff on site. Pay someone to do it. You know, again, take 2% out of your profit and give it to somebody to manage and go on, because you will be able to move straight onto another deal and crack on, and you will make way beyond that 2% in not ballsing up things on site, not getting involved when you shouldn't, and having a pipeline of stuff to get on with. That I work with so many developers that just can't get continuity. They cannot move from one project to another without having serious delays in between, and that is because the planning system messes them up. But then they get too involved on site, and their eye is off the ball. And while they are involved on site, standing there with Ricky asking them what bond this is and pointing out to a decorator that there's a smudge in the paintwork, while they're doing that, somebody else is buying the deals that they're not buying and setting themselves up a pipeline. So if you want to be a hands-on developer, You know, just understand that realistically what you are, if you're doing that, is you're a builder that gets to make a bit more profit by selling the things that they're building. Yeah. If you want to be a developer, if you want to be a proper investor developer, then you employ the right people to do the job and you let them get on with it and you go out and find deals. That's what you should be doing. Invest your time in the right place. Know what's going on. Yeah, have a good team and understand what's going on and you know, visit your sites and ask your questions and you know, what have you. But don't get involved. You know, get a project manager in if you want to go down a managed route. You know, that and that would be so a managed contract would be where you have a main construction manager, a project manager who then brings in lots of separate trades. So you pay for that skill set to micro tender lots and lots of different packages. You might get a D&B contractor in where you've got your planning permission and you just throw the drawings over to a contractor and say, right, you design it, you build it, I'm going to give you some money and that's that, what we call a turnkey approach. Or you might go down a traditional route where you employ a builder and you employ all of your design team, so your architect and your M&E consulting structure engineer to essentially work up the project together on site, realistically, there's not a huge amount of difference in cost from one to another. What you get is you get a balance of anyone that's looked into procurement will understand that there are three factors that we're trying to deal with. So we're trying to deal with time, we're trying to deal with cost, and we're trying to deal with quality. Now, if your project needs to be done quickly and it needs to be high quality, then you go down a managed contract route. Yeah. So if your project needs to be done low cost and low time, then you go down the D&B route and you lose quality for going down the D&B route. If you need to keep quality up and you need to keep time high, then you go down the managed route, but you lose the ability to keep control over cost. And if it's the last one, if it's cost and quality, then you go down the traditional route, but you lose the ability to control time in the same way. So it really is a case of understanding what's the most important factors for your project or your investment strategy, and then following that procurement route accordingly to get what you need out of the project.
So summing that all up, then you would say that as long as the investor knows what they want, then they'll be able to make a more efficient decision.
Yeah. But don't think that one shoe fits all. You know, if you're doing high end projects, don't expect to get a high quality finish on a D&B contract where you've just thrown somebody the planning drawings. Yeah, you know, don't expect it, because it won't happen. Because what will happen is you'll get pulled apart on site by a contractor that gets you to sign a set of employer's requirement documents that are so loose that they can get away with doing anything. And then you will come to suffer 6 months down the line when all of your units are sold and they're coming back with problems. And then you are paying that money that you thought you were saving, you are now paying out and getting things fixed. And the contractors, you know, pulled your pants down because they got you to sign documents in the first place and you didn't, you know, that didn't suit for the development that you want to do. So understand what it is that you're trying to achieve, and then use the correct procurement route and the team for that. But it is different for each one. You know, if it's a set of HMOs where you're in a low cost area and you just need them to be fit for purpose, and you know you're going to refurb them every year, then sure, D&B, don't spend much money on it. Send someone in, put a paint and a saw, and they'll do what you need them to do. It's the right procurement team for the right project.
Awesome stuff. And yeah, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. Before we go into getting into the summary section and bits and pieces like that, always like to go through some examples, whether that's examples of deals that you've done personally or, you know, Scroxton and Partners have done, just so people can have an idea of the level of different projects that you do Can you give us a few examples of some deals that you've done for clients?
Yeah, so we've worked on all sorts. So one of the ones that sticks out is a project that we did in Bushy, where it was a little backland. It used to be a garage. It was horrible little site, really. You could barely get in there, and we were asked to. I said, I'm sure, the numbers are right in my head. I'm sure we were asked to get 9 units on there initially. We looked at it from an architect's point of view, and we said, well, actually, we think we can. Yeah, your investment numbers might say that you need 9 units to make this stack, but we think we can get you. You know, at the time, we thought we could get them 15. So we did the process, and we got that first planning application signed up at 15, and then through negotiating with the local authority, we then went back and added another 4 units on and got it up to 19. That was all through good design, and that made a huge difference to that project. That was a case of essentially doubling the planning gain that the developer thought they were going to get on that project, and made it so they just didn't need to lift a finger in the end. They made their exit very, very quickly on that, and they've done that through good design. Another good example. So the one that I burnt my fingers on. So that was 6 flats down in West London, and that failed for a couple of reasons. That failed because the person who was in control of the finances took the approach that you shouldn't tell the lenders when there were problems. And that is the worst thing you can do. You've got to understand that if you're dealing with other people's money, you need to be highly respectful of that, and you need to tell them. If you've dropped a pound down the drain on your way in, you need to phone them up and you need to let them know what you've done and how you're going to get that pound back. You can't fuck about with people's money and expect them to be nice to you when it all unravels. But also, that was also one where when you actually went into the deal structure, so much was misunderstood. Things were filed in the wrong places, such as SIL. SIL was filed in as a cost for the builder. And so when we unraveled what was going on, and the contractor's there saying, I'm owed 70 grand, where is it? And the one in charge of the finances is saying, no, you're not. no, it's all been spent. It's all been paid. It didn't add up because things were put in the wrong pot. So again, knowledge around the numbers, knowledge around stacking a deal is what essentially killed that, and being way too optimistic on exit figures. And then I guess a third good example would be there's so many projects going on in your head, and all of a sudden you can't think of which ones to talk about. On an HMO front, I think. This was a little commercial conversion that was. So the first one was commercial. The second one wasn't commercial. This one was a commercial, and it was a little shoe factory in the centre of Northampton, and that was, in the end, it worked out. It worked out okay. It's only 5 units, I think. But we managed to get that one through, and then we improved it with the planning permission afterwards. So we got the commercial conversion done to get the base of the building sorted out with 4 units, and then there was unusable bit of land in the middle of the site. So we managed to get a 5th unit essentially through planning permission on that site, and that really brought the brought the value up. So the commercial conversion was only really kicking in at a bit of a break-even point, and we needed the planning process to bring it up and get it over the line. And I think that's maybe a good example there of understanding that if you know all of the routes, if you know committed development and you know planning opportunities and policies, then you can enhance a scheme that was never going to make anybody money, any money whatsoever. You can enhance with an additional route. So you can enhance a PD conversion with a planning application a bit further down the line. You can enhance a commercial conversion potentially with a couple of floors of additional a bit further down the line. So knowing those other routes to exit just gives you that. Again, yeah, for me, it's all about getting the most value for people, for developers, out of a project. Because if we get the most value out of a project, it gives you the ability to go and do more. And if we are gonna solve the housing crisis one house at a time, it's going to be by allowing developers to go and do more stuff on other sites.
Probably should have asked this near the start, to be honest, so I've just thought of it now, is if in terms of finding these deals or these sites, what's the best way to go about it? Because if you buy in regular bog standard residential for buy to let, you normally go Rightmove, speak to an estate agent, etc., etc. But when we're talking about these sort of larger buildings, different style buildings, how would people go about trying to find them in the first place?
First of all, you've got to know who owns. So the look for, nothing's better than driving around first of all to understand your areas. But once you've got the area that you're targeting and you think you're in the right spot, the next thing to do is to trawl the land registry and try and find where you've got buildings that line up with the people that are in the building. So the ownership lines up with the company that's in the building, because they're the ones where you've got the best chance of striking a deal with someone for a couple of reasons. One, they probably bought that building a few years ago. And so in their heads, let's say they bought it 10 years ago for £100,000. In their heads, they're thinking, "What? Anything I get over £100,000 is going to be a good deal." In reality, obviously, we all know through appreciation that building is probably worth closer to 200 now. So you've got they're anchored where they bought, and so you've got some room for negotiation in there. Obviously, you're going to get valuations and things, but still, you've got a good anchor point. And when you explain what you're trying to do, The conversation can be a lot better. You can also get into you're talking to the right person to get into an option. You're also probably not going to be dealing with somebody that owns hundreds of buildings. You're dealing with somebody that owns one building. So if they own one building, they're focused on talking about this project. If you're trying to buy buildings off of landlords that own 50 in the street, they're getting their income, they don't really care, they've got a capital appreciation model going on. You're not picking the right battles. So talk to the owner occupiers, get them involved, explain what you're trying to do with permitting development and planning gains and stuff. Show them where they're going to make their money that they didn't think they were going to get. You're going to get lots and lots of distressed businesses over the next few months. Again, it's owner-occupiers that you're going to be able to deal with easily because they're going to be motivated to do something about the situation that's coming down the line, particularly if their business is under pressure. There will be motivation with commercial landlords that own multiple properties, but they're savvy. They're property savvy, and they will be doing it themselves. Why get involved with you when all they've got to do is find out their existing power network that got them to the position that they're in and pivot. So that I think is probably the best way to do it. Drive around, find the places, and then find the buildings that are owned by the people that are in them, or at worst case, the ones that where they don't have multiple, if it's just a single owner that might be renting out and getting a little bit of rent, but they don't have a massive property portfolio. Again, they're another good target to talk to, but you have to do it through you have to do it through trawling the land registry. It's the only way. You will see stuff on Rightmove. You will see potential deals on Rightmove. But if you're seeing them, so is everyone else. And there's already an agent involved who's already told someone that there's a possibility of a permitted development gain here, and they've talked them into a position that you're going to then have to try and talk them back from to get the value in the deal, because agents seem to think that there's no such thing as interest when it comes to financing these deals, and they essentially stack everything as though it's being bought by someone with cash. Get straight to direct to vendor, but do it through a lot of legwork on land registry, and you should be able to pick up, particularly over the next 24 months. It's horrible to see it. It's horrible to say, but this is where deals are going to come out. There's going to be a lot of distressed commercial building owners that are going to need to exit, and you can help them exit safely and make sure they don't lose the shirts off their backs, whilst also making sure you get a great deal for yourself. So it's a good time for this, I think.
The last main question I have before we go into that semi-quickfire round is going back to costs. Is there a rough, guide up and down the country? Of course, every area is different and it depends on your style of the finish, what you're doing. But in terms of working out a cost per square meter or square foot, is there a rough guide of what that should be? Or again, is that just deal dependent? Speak to an architect.
It's so deal dependent. I think that the danger of giving out a rough rule of thumb is that you then rely on it, and until you can't really get a rule of thumb until you've done a handful of deals yourself in a particular area, and then you can average out across those deals. You can't really look and say one building, that every PD conversion is gonna be roughly X amount per square foot, and that's where that real danger comes in. That if you do, that's where you're gonna catch a cold. That's where you really do want to either talk to an architect, or in that instance, this is where you might have a friendly QS that has done a couple of these jobs before and can look at it and say, you've got these basic costs, but on this particular one, you're going to have another staircase that you've got to put in. But that's the difference on this one. And that's why these deals sometimes, that's why people overpay, is because they try and use a rule of thumb process. Unlike new builds, where pretty much, other than ground conditions, once you've dealt with the ground conditions, everything is pretty much the same. Yeah. So you can give a rule of thumb for new builds, no worries. Conversions, there is all those little dangers like asbestos and whatever. So you'd have to put in such a huge contingency to deal with a rule of thumb that it's not worth me. It's not worth me damaging my reputation by giving a figure there, unfortunately.
That's absolutely fine. That's the purpose of the episode, is to get, that's the purpose of this, is to get people's mindset in the right place for when they're looking at doing this. So that's not a problem at all, Neil. So moving on to this sort of semi-quickfire then, some very generic things here. What would you say are the most common concerns or queries you hear from investors when they're looking at commercial conversions for the very first time?
Oh, am I going to make any money on this? We get asked a lot. Is this worth it? Is this what offer can I make? Really that comes down to this, because there is such a how long's a piece of string question when it comes to what's it going to cost to convert this building? It's the first question that we always get asked is how much, what can I offer?
Fair enough.
For people that are wanting to get into the strategy, and again, you've mentioned a lot of top tips, so far, and it's been fantastic. If you had to summarise into the three main tips to give people for getting into the strategy, what would you advise and what would you say to them?
Three main, due diligence, go and really, really, really stress test it. Slow it down. You're better off walking away from a deal than walking into a shit deal. So slow it down, do your due diligence, make sure that you're happy with costs before you put your offer in. So that's number one. Number two, again, due diligence is phone up the local authority and make sure that the building you're about to buy is the class use that you think it is, because that's a massive clanger if you mess that one up. And number three would be, understand your exit properly off of this. Certain buildings are just not suitable. Certain buildings are suitable for HMOs. Certain buildings are suitable for flats that can be rented out. Certain buildings are suitable for flats that can be sold. If you understand your exit strategy and don't walk into every building thinking that it's right for what you've been doing. Don't shoehorn a solution into a building. Let the building, tell you what it's suitable for. And then again, if it's not your strategy, if it's not your cup of tea, walk away from it. There'll be another one around the corner. There will be another one around the corner. But it's very, very easy to get caught out with something that you don't know, or again, leave money on the table because you're trying to shoehorn it in the wrong strategy to a particular building.
Talking of the strategy, where do you see commercial conversions being in the future?
I think we've had our peak, if I'm honest with you. I think we have had our peak on commercial conversions. I still think there's plenty there to be done, but I think it's moving now, like I said, to some of those other class uses. So, like I said, moving on to the high streets more and looking at those airspace opportunities. That's really, it's now going to be about combining commercial conversions with something else to get the to get the cream in the deal, because the heady days of just picking up an office for the price of an office and converting it, and we've got hundreds of units, no parking, it's all that's gone. There's too many people anti that type of development, so now it's about looking at things and seeing the next step on from the commercial conversion position and understanding where there's extra meat on the bones.
Perfect. Well, there's only two left, so very simple. Number one is, if people actually want to find out more about yourself and Scoxton and Partners, how can they do that?
Just visit us at www.scoxtonpartners.co.uk. Or drop me a line, n.scroxton@scroxtonpartners.co.uk. Our website's got a lot of information on it. We're also starting to build up a bit more collateral on channels like YouTube and LinkedIn. So again, search for Scroxton Partners on YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, where we're trying to discuss things that affect residential developers as well as householders, to get a bit more of a conversation around some of these sort of pitfalls that people fall into, and if there's nothing there that ticks the box that you're looking for, drop me a line, drop me an email, and I will put something on there so that it relates more to what your issues are.
Perfect stuff, and we'll put links to the show notes as we always do, so people can click through there as well. Also mentioned that you very kindly recently wrote some extra tips for 101 top property tips, so thank you for that. You go and buy that on Amazon if you're listening as well. And Neil, any final words of wisdom, words of encouragement to those listening?
Property is it's awesome. It's the most noble thing that you can invest your money in. We do have a housing crisis, and don't listen to what the media says that it's bad to be a property developer, it's bad to be a landlord, it's bad to own property. Bullshit. It's fucking great to own property. It's great to create homes and houses for families that need it. Just don't be an arsehole about it. Just, you know, go out and do a good job, and, you know, make a good profit. But also do it with a good heart, and understand the importance of what you're doing. And you'll have a great career in property, and it will look after you and your family and all the families that live in the units that you create and rent. So, I love it. I love being in property, and you will too if you're not already.
Well, awesome stuff. We'll leave it at that, Neil. Again, very, very informative. Thank you very much for your time.
It's okay.